very warm welcome to all of you, especially those of you who have met before, and the warmest welcome of all to Christina. We're really glad that you were able to get here. As the weather got worse, we wondered. So it's great that we're able to get going today. I'm just going to do ordinary domestic details, which many of you will have heard before, so if I forget anything, you can tell me. The first thing to say is about the fire exits. If the fire alarm should go, the main staircase is the obvious route, but there is an alternative route. If you go straight ahead out of this room, through the double doors, down a few stairs, there's another door to the right, which goes down some stairs out into the courtyard. They are clearly labelled. The toilets are on the ground floor, again, clearly labelled. I would ask you please to switch off or put your mobile phones on silent, if you wouldn't mind. We're asked not to bring food or hot drinks into this room because of the carpet and because it's the main room that the friends use for their worship. But we have provided water downstairs and glasses. And we just ask you if you wouldn't mind filling up the jugs if you think they need them, and washing up your own glass at the end of the day. Hot drinks will be available at the top. The walking meditation rooms, there's a small room on this floor and a larger room on the ground floor, and you can also use the stairways and the hallway because we've got the whole house for us today. There will be a bell rung 5 minutes before the end of each walking period, and Christina will give instructions about the walking meditation. I ask you please to keep your valuables with you. There have been thefts from meditation days, unfortunately. It's particularly try not to leave anything valuable downstairs in your pocket, really. The front doors are kept open so that people from the street can wander in. The other thing to say is that, as usual, today we'll be in silence to support our practice. And again, Christine will talk more about that. I think that I don't need to introduce Christine Bellman in any more detail, except to say thank you very much for coming.
So I'd also like to welcome you to this day long and applaud you for your willingness to take a day to be still, particularly at this time of year when our world seems to get so very busy and agitated. I'm a great supporter of urban retreats. Probably as many of you know, I tend to spend a lot of time in silent retreat centers where people leave their lives for more extended periods of time to practice and to be silent and to be still. But I think there is something equally important about learning how to bring this practice into something that is a little closer to the rest of our lives. You know, the world of movement, cars, people, sound, busyness. Because this is really, if this practice that we do here and cultivate means anything, it's only if it makes a difference to how we actually live in the world that we are part of. So there is something, I think, quite unique and wonderful about the capacity to create a kind of a refuge, an inner refuge within this world of movement. And having these day-longs, I think, in more urban environments is so much an encouragement to explore that possibility of finding that kind of core or place of stillness and calmness and ease within ourselves. Let's talk a little bit about the framework of today. We will hold it in silence. It's an opportunity to step back a little bit from performance anxiety and having to be someone special or impress or anything else. Also an opportunity to be able to listen a little bit more inwardly. But in the day, I will also have a couple of periods where there's some space for questions or reflection. And the theme I really wanted to work with today is the theme of contentment, inner contentment, and exploring what that means for us. Contentment is a word that is mentioned with great frequency in the Buddhist teaching. To find an inner ease, a sense of sufficiency, a sense of enough, having enough, enough fulfillment, enough calmness in each moment. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist teaching are probably very aware that the Buddha did not, of course, just teach formal meditation, sitting on a cushion or walking slowly. That the very essence, the very heart of the Buddhist teaching was about living an awakened life. And certainly I encounter very often in teaching in the West that there's this curious misapprehension about the Buddhist teaching, that somehow so much weight, perhaps too much weight, is put upon just beginning and ending meditation. Sit on a cushion, go on a retreat, walk slowly, and feeling that somehow this is the whole of the path. And almost kind of imagining that sitting on a cushion has some kind of magical power to transform us, which clearly it doesn't. But the Buddha very much taught, what does it mean to live an awakened life? He taught a path which embraces every aspect of our lives, about how we rub up against the people we love and those that we don't know and those that we struggle with, about how we engage in our work, our livelihood, about how we engage in our relationships, about the quality of our communications, our speech. All of this very much included in what was called a path, a life of understanding, a life of insight that is embodied. Embodied. Now, there are two words that feature very, very strongly in this teaching. One word is bhavana, and I will explain these, and the other word is kusala in Pali. Now, bhavana translates as to bring into being, to cultivate, and actually it is often translated as meditation. But that's really too limited a translation of it. The other word is kusala, which translates as ennobling, that which ennobles, that which brings dignity, that which brings a sense of uprightness, of completeness, of respect into our life. So this first word, bhavana, which is widely used to describe all forms of meditation, the question of what we are cultivating, being aware that in every moment of our life, every moment of our day, of course, something is coming into being in our minds, in our hearts, in our lives. Something is being brought into being. Some of this can often feel to be quite unconscious. We find anger coming into being, or irritation, or anxiety, or worry or fear being brought into being. It can often feel quite unconscious. So the Buddha is really inviting us to kind of shift our orientation and to have a sense of more consciously cultivating a heart and a life and a mind, which leads to peace, which leads to freedom, which leads to integrity. So there's this ongoing sense of, in our lives, in our practice, to cultivate compassion, kindness, generosity, patience, all of the qualities that really enable us to be a conscious participant in the world that we live in the world that we are part of. The other word, kusala, ennobling, many people tell me they find this a very difficult word, the sense of nobility and cultivating a noble life. You know, it can all sound terribly pretentious, you know, and rather perhaps a bit arrogant or something, you know, to actually say, well, I'm on a path of nobility, you know. And yet we cannot mistake or you know, how much this word noble or ennobling is mentioned in the teaching. We talk about the noble eightfold path. That which is a life of skillfulness, of kindness, of compassion, of wisdom. We talk about the four noble ennobling truths, the understandings that really liberate the heart, that liberate the mind. And as pretentious as it might perhaps initially sound, I would like to really invite you and encourage you to actually reflect upon what it might mean for you to live a noble life. To cultivate qualities that are ennobling. And when the Buddha talks about cultivating that which is ennobling, it's not terribly pretentious what he's talking about. He's talking about what we all love, compassion, kindness, love, forgiveness, generosity, patience, stillness. Now, in my sense, another the great genius of the Buddha is that he tends to always build upon what we already know, what we have already glimpsed in our lives. And I think if we reflect upon it, we would probably recognize that we've all had glimpses, no matter how brief they are. We've all had glimpses of the landscape of kindness. There's been moments in our lives where we've glimpsed compassion, calmness, peace, intimacy. There's been moments when we've been touched by the generosity and the patience of others. We may have come across really exceptional moments in our lives, in nature or with ourselves and with others, where there's somehow a kind of an opening into a sense of stillness, of being fully present, of vastness, of spaciousness. And if we think about it, all of these moments, no matter how brief they are, they inspire us. They give us a sense of possibility. That this is how our minds, this is how our hearts can actually. They often feel a little mysterious too. They seem like accidents. And we can have a moment of stillness and then somehow just be swept away with preoccupations, a host of worries and fantasies and obsessions. And we can almost feel like that is more normal. I think in this teaching, the ideas of what is normal in our mind are deeply questioned. It is actually, I think, considered in this teaching the host of preoccupations and worries that often beset us, that this is not really the very nature of our hearts. It's not the nature of our minds. It points to somehow a way that we've in some way kind of lost our way. The moments that we glimpse stillness or calmness or peace, they are in many ways a kind of taste of freedom. And they are a glimpse of the potentiality, the possibility of each of our hearts and minds. My experience in speaking with people is, you know, an awareness of how we can be kind of problem-centered in our culture. That we often live in the landscape of the difficult. the arguments that we have with the world, the arguments we have with ourselves and others, the conflicts, the disappointments, how often we are focused on all that is imperfect. And of course that tendency to be more problem-centered can very much, like all tendencies, just get transferred into our meditation practice. And so we can sit and walk and be fretting about whether we have a perfect breath or, you know, the right kind of experience, or we have too much dullness, or we have too much agitation, or we have too much doubt, we have too much anxiety. And we may even, in that, come to believe that after we've solved and fixed all that is difficult, all that is wrong, then somehow we're going to stumble across this mysterious calmness and stillness and peace. Interestingly, in this teaching, that kind of thinking is very much reversed. For sure, there is an acknowledgement of the adversity and the afflictions and the difficult that are part of all of our lives. There's no dismissal of that. There's an acknowledgement that this is very much part of the human story to be understood. But there's a reversal in the sense that it is really suggested in this path that in the midst of this we focus our attention, we focus our minds, we focus our hearts on cultivating that which eases the difficult. We cultivate the lovely and the liberating in the midst of the difficult. Reb Anderson, a much loved Zen teacher, once said that Buddhas don't practice in the suburbs of suffering. They practice downtown. And I think that's a curious reversal. This is actually where we practice, not waiting for things to go away. We can see that, you know, if we have this kind of mindset where, you know, I need to get rid of this, I need to fix this, I need to make this go away in order to find calmness, in order to find stillness, it becomes a kind of postponement practice, doesn't it? Tomorrow's a much better day to be awake in, you know. There's surely a much better moment to be really present in, you know, a much preferable moment to really open to. And it becomes a kind of postponement practice where too much of our agenda is about how do I change the landscape, you know, the furniture in my mind, the furniture in my life. And actually this teaching is about how do I change the way that I see that nature. What do I cultivate in myself? Kindness, patience, spaciousness, ease, compassion. The seeds of these live within all of us, within our own minds and hearts. And this teaching is one of really nurturing and cultivating and bringing to fruition those seeds that live within us. The very central, I think, in the Buddhist teaching is this one simple premise that the source of joy and the source of sorrow lives in our own heart. That the source of imprisonment and the source of freedom lives within our own consciousness, our own mind. Of course, in our life, there is hardship. Life also brings us much that is lovely and delightful, and we will all have our own measure of these. Yet so much sorrow is born of resistance and aversion and demand and insistence, just as so much joy is born of aligning ourselves with the way things actually are. And much of this practice, really much of what we do in meditation, is bringing our constructs about reality just a little bit closer to the way things actually are. Because that's where we find peace. That's where we find stillness. That's where we find calmness as we put down the arguments. it's in no way a recipe for passivity. It's in no way a prescription for withdrawing from wise action and wise response. But it is knowing that there's very little wisdom in action or speech that actually arises from the agitated mind. So it is always our first invitation, and I might say our first task, our first challenge too, in this practice, to constantly return to ourselves, to look at the state of our own mind, to find peace with what is. Meditation is always relational. It is not finding peace or compassion as some sort of isolated state. It is in relationship to what is. In my understanding, you know, you hear the word in Buddhist teaching dissatisfaction or unsatisfactoriness quite a lot. And in my understanding, there's two qualities of dissatisfaction. That there's an immature, kind of reactive dissatisfaction. And there's a quality, I think, of mature dissatisfaction. I think immature dissatisfaction is when we project happiness, the possibility of happiness, of peace, of love, onto things. Say, you have the power to make me happy. You know, you have the power. If I get this, I will be happy. If I don't get this, I will be unhappy. How much we are go through life projecting onto objects and experiences and people, situation, this power to govern our hearts, the power to govern our mind, almost as if the world and everything in it becomes the gatekeeper of our well-being. And when that projection is taking place, of course, a lot of our life becomes very agitated. Because we're chasing this, because it will make us happy. We're avoiding this, we're rearranging this, we're trying to get this or get rid of this. A lot of our life becomes very agitated simply because this basic proposition isn't questioned about whether the objects and experiences actually hold the power to govern our hearts. And that's a kind of immature dissatisfaction, I think, which keeps us very, very busy as we run from one disappointment to another. You know, as we just run from one disappointment to another. And then there's another quality of mature dissatisfaction. When we're actually question that restlessness, question that discontent, and question actually whether the possibility of genuine, free, liberated contentment lies within us. And we actually no longer willing to deliver our freedom into the hands of conditions that we cannot control, that we cannot always govern. I think immature dissatisfaction is built upon the belief in insufficiency. It's built upon the belief in insufficiency. I am not enough. There's not enough within me. I am not good enough. I am not able enough. I'm not compassionate enough. I'm not calm enough. That belief in insufficiency, which makes us so agitated in our life, chasing, pursuing, avoiding. And my understanding is this whole teaching is built upon the premise of sufficiency, that each of us holds within us a remarkable capacity for inner freedom, for compassion, for kindness, and the path is simply the invitation to discover that. To discover that. The mature dissatisfaction is no longer being satisfied with delivering that inner potentiality into the hands of conditions. So we come to contentment. Contentment, because there's something about discovering sufficiency rests upon our willingness to be still, rests upon our willingness to turn towards the moment, to turn towards what is, to look at what is the landscape of discontent, How do we know that in our lives? What does the landscape of discontent look like? It looks a lot like the landscape of insufficiency. To really look at how that gets embodied in our lives in terms of prowling the world or in terms of aversion. It is also the encouragement to look at the landscape of contentment. What does the landscape of inner contentment actually look like to us? Is it an accident, or is it something that we cultivate each time we kind of step out of the agitation, step out of the restlessness, step out of the busyness, and just breathe out. Just breathe out. And just settle into this body, this mind, this heart, just as it is the way that we begin to open the door to a sense of inner contentment. It's very challenging, but it's actually very hard to live in the landscape of discontent, hard on us. It's very painful to live in the language of discontent. So, I'd like to start the morning with a sitting, but before we do that, if it's helpful to you, just stand up and shake out your body a little bit.